Tom Gimbel is the job expert and founder of the LaSalle Network. We frequently go to on this show, and here we go again. Tom, welcome back to WGN Radio. How are you today?
Doing great. How are you, sir?
Good. So this jobs report is coming up. What else are you looking at today?
Well, I think the main thing of the jobs report is looking at what the participation rate is going to be. I think that's a huge part of what we're talking about is, are we getting more people working, John? And we're looking, you know, the two things that doesn't get looked at enough by the layman is, number one, what's the participation rate? Do we have more people getting jobs and in the workforce? And number two is, are hourly rates going up? Are people making more money? Those are the two things, in addition to just the unemployment rate, that we need to look at.
4.2%, I think, was the last number I saw. So we want wages to go up. The hourly rate, is it good if those go up, or is that inflationary?
No, it's both. It's both. Listen, when you have people making more money, it is a push for inflation. But at the same time, you know, we're really battling a couple different fronts at the same time. Number one is, what's good for the economy? Number two is, what's good for the consumer and the average worker? And then number three, what's the perceived value? And I think that's the thing that really gets lost, is people perceive that they're making more money, that that's better. But what inflation really is if everybody's making more money and the cost of goods go up, your dollar isn't going any farther. And that's the problem we've had in this economy for the past 2 or 3 years that's really affected everybody. And when they say it's the economy, that's it, because we see the stock market going up. We know that unemployment's low, yet at this point in time, it's harder for people to find a job. It's such an interesting economy, and we didn't have these problems 10 years ago.
Are you optimistic about 2025?
I'm optimistic for the first half of the year. I think we're going to see a rally due to lack of regulations and easing up on regulations and the pro-business economy that people believe we're going to have with the change in the administration. I do think that history tells us that the first year of a new administration, it tends to be a laggard on the economy. And I think that no bull run lasts forever. And so I am a little bit hesitant. Where I'm really a little bit nervous about, more than anything else, John, is in kids coming out of college or having a harder time finding a job than I've seen in a long, long time, going back to the Great Recession. And that concerns me, that when kids coming out of college at that $45,000 to $60,000 a year level and those jobs aren't as plentiful, that gives me a little room for pause.
Why? What's going to happen?
Well, if they don't have jobs, you know, that you're going to end up saying, if the economy and the businesses aren't going to be able to support hiring people on the lower end of the white collar salary, that eventually that's going to lead to a recession, because those kids coming in is what really fuel, you know, you got to refuel the system, and college grads refuel the system. They come in, they get promoted, they are the ones that become new renters when they move out of their parents' house. They're buying fast food. They're spending money on that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And if they're not having jobs, you got a real problem on the economy.
I saw a piece in Inc., 6 Ways the Workplace Will Change in 2025. More talent searches will start inside. I didn't know that they were looking outside the company, but that's hiring from within. Is that what that means?
Yeah, it's really saying that we've got to look within. If we're a company, a Fortune 1000 company, or even a couple hundred person medium-sized business, is that we've got to be looking at people from different areas for what their skill sets are. And a lot of the jobs that people do in traditional companies, you know, if you're writing code, that's a different ballgame. But if you're in marketing or you're in sales, even some entry-level roles in accounting that you don't have to be a CPA for, you know, there's so many administratively focused jobs that people can do if given the opportunity. And if you've got people who are proven corporate culture givers, who are good people, why not give them a shot when you can do that and save money at the same time?
One of the things this article also talks about is the burnout level that at least HR managers, and maybe others as well, have been experiencing. What about that, and how does that change in the new year?
You know what, John? I've never been one to buy into the whole burnout philosophy. I think that you work hard, you love what you do, and you're good at it. You keep growing. If you don't like it, you feel that you're burnt out because you just don't like the job. And over a period of time, sometimes people need change, whether it be within the company or leaving the company for a change to recharge. But if you work any job long enough, John, you have bad years. In the beginning, you have a bad week. After a couple of years, you might have a bad month. You stay someplace for 8, 10, 12, 15 years, you're going to have a bad year. And that's okay, and you fight through that. But that's what burnout is. It's a bad year. You fight through it, you overcome, you re-engage, you find your energy, and you give back in. I think we're going to see a return to employer and employee loyalty, and the people that are going to return to the office, the people that want to stay with their company, that want to learn how to work within the parameters of AI,
right,
the people that see the opportunities that exist, companies are going to want those people, and they're going to have a lot of loyalty. And I think the two-way street of loyalty is going to return.
For the first time now, Gen Zers will outnumber baby boomers in the workforce. Next year, about 1 in 10 managers will be Gen Z, according to another report. Gen Zers are moving up the ranks. What does that mean to the business community?
Well, number one, if you're taking a baby boomer out and replacing with a Gen Z, that means there's a salary delta that goes down, right? The baby boomer's making more money than the Gen Z. So you have a situation where you have people that are more mobily upwards on the corporate ladder. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Secondarily, when you have, you know, you need people that want to take the reins and move up. And you know what happens to very young, more liberally focused people as they get older, John?
No.
They have families, they incur more debt, they create more responsibility for themselves, and they become more conservative like their parents.
Yeah.
And so you always need to replenish the well with young, aggressive, motivated, more liberal thinkers, because over time, they become the former generation. So you really need to replenish that well.
I don't have time for all of these, but one last quick note here. The article in Inc. says that DEI programs are going to go away, or at least a lot of them will go away. McDonald's just announced they're no longer interested in DEI. I don't know what companies are supposed to do about that. Seems to me like the idea behind it was all pretty good, but then the execution of it might have been unpopular or unfair or sloppy. If a company gets rid of DEI, I'm just editorializing here a little bit, Tom. I can be agnostic about that, but I don't like it if they're doing it for political reasons, to either curry favor with the new administration.
Yeah.
It's almost becoming its own kind of woke, like, well, here's the new way we're all going to be. And I don't want them to do it for that reason. I want them to do it or not be DEI inclusive if it's good for business and good for employees.
I think what got bent out of shape here, John, and we're happy to talk about it next week, but I think what really happened was the majority of companies that are forward-thinking and growth-oriented, they're inclusionist because they want to attract people internally who look like their clients and their customers. That was always happened. What happened over the past few years, and it came out of COVID and the George Floyd situation, was an apologetic behavior if you weren't moving at 100 miles an hour to create some form of fake equality. And sometimes things have to happen innately and grow. But I tell you, I talk to CEOs, CFOs, HR leaders every day, every week, every month, and I will tell you, to a woman and to a man, they all want to have the best people of diverse backgrounds, but doing it for the wrong reasons is a recipe for disaster.
Tom Gimbel's the job expert and founder of the LaSalle Network. You have a good new year, and let's talk next week, Tom.
Absolutely. Stay healthy, and here's to a great 25, John.
Philip Weiss is the president of Cyfarth at Work. Philip, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, John, and happy new year to you.
No more meeting captives at Illinois companies is your headline. I don't know what you're talking about, sir.
Yes, and that is something that you have in common with a lot of business owners, John, who should be aware of this law that's coming into effect as we speak across Illinois. It's a really fascinating development, and Illinois' in a way, on the vanguard with a number of other states in terms of what is called captive audience legislation. In essence, what it means is employers in Illinois can no longer require their employees to attend meetings or trainings or sessions where political or religious positions are presented to them. The reason that's critical is quite often a company might think to itself, look it, there are candidates running for office that support our industry. There are values that matter to us as a company that might be rooted in some religious tenet. We'd love to share that with our employees. They really should know. But now Illinois is saying you can't require people to listen to those messages. You can't even incentivize them by paying them to attend those meetings. So for many companies, John, it's a 180 turn if they've been thinking this is a safe way to go.
Does that happen a lot?
Surprisingly, yes. And it happens in a couple of instances. One, John, is where a company was founded by a family or individual who had very strongly held beliefs, and those beliefs have guided the company ever since and are part of new employee orientation, part of annual all-employee meetings. So that's one place where we see it happening quite often. Another place, which is a little trickier, in fact, is there might be a manager who holds a team meeting, and that manager is used to including messages that are not always work-related and might veer into the political, religious, or other risky topic areas under the newest law, and they don't even think twice. Obviously, employees cannot beg off a manager team-wide meeting, so it's something to be thought about by both supervisors and owners.
Are you saying I can't have a prayer to start a meeting?
That would be risky, to say the least. And obviously, what's really fascinating about your question is there's all of these cases about religion in the workplace. And employees themselves sometimes will want to know how far they can go in terms of talking about religion. And there's some really interesting examples where employees have put, for example, on their own workspaces, a small religious symbol, a cross, a star, an Islamic symbol. And obviously that's a personal decision that doesn't really affront, affect, or intrude on others' beliefs. But once it becomes a broader required discussion, it gets riskier. So employees have to think about it, but definitely companies and managers have got to put this on their radar looking forward.
I wonder if the answer would also be, yes, you can have a prayer at a meeting, but then you can't mandate that the employees all attend or punish them if they don't.
Yeah, so this is the kind of discussion a lot of employers are having. You know, one exception, which is not going to surprise you, John, are religious institutions or not-for-profits where they are devoted in terms of their entire mission to a political activity or advocacy. They're going to be exempted from this law. But if you're not in one of those categories, you do want to think twice, because some employees at a minimum will feel, if I say no, if I don't go, and everyone else on my team is going because there's some commentary, prayer, et cetera, what's going to happen in terms of how I'm perceived? So this is something that really employers are taking a hard look at and erring on the side of caution if, in fact, people might feel compelled, even if it's not written in the rules, so to speak. It's kind of, there's a letter of the law, John, and there's the implicit impact of having it as a practice as well. So you're bringing up the very questions employers are grappling with right now.
Religion and politics, you mentioned. What about if I hang over the side of my cubicle a Palestinian flag or a star?
Yeah, so this goes to that earlier example. It's really kind of hot topic. And the idea here is, on the one hand, some companies have been very sort of stringent and or cautious about ensuring that political insignia in general are not displayed in the workplace. That includes logos on clothing, et cetera. When it comes to religion, it's a little bit different, because the notion of a private expression of religion is something companies understand is part of people's identity and has been part of their lives since perhaps a very young age. So this private expression, let's say a pendant around one's neck, is very different than perhaps holding a giant placard with an image of a prophet as you walk around the hallway. Yeah. There's that kind of advertising versus private expression. That's a really clear line for a lot of employers and employees.
So maybe the HR person is, or the manager is sitting down with one or both of the persons, the aggrieved and the other person that's causing some friction, possibly unintentionally, and maybe on a case-by-case basis trying to manage it, huh?
Yeah, that happens. So it's really interesting you raise it. The other really effective strategy, John, is because you can't cover every single example. I mean, you brought up three or four yourself just right now. Can't cover every example in a policy or rule. So one really effective strategy is in training and orientation to have a bunch of these examples, a range of political, religious, and other examples that an employee themselves might be presenting, projecting, or sharing. And I'm asking the group, do you know somebody that might be offended by this, that it might be too much for them to see it? They might feel pressured.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's amazing is employees to a person realize, you know what? I won't want to be pressured. Maybe I should not pressure others either in terms of my view. So that consensus is really a great tool.
It's a new law in Illinois, the captive audience law. If you've got questions about this, maybe you ought to reach out to Philip Weiss, the president of Seyfarth at Work, SeyFarth, SeyfarthAtWork.com. Thank you, Philip.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Always fun to have Tom Appel on the Business Lunch. He is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. He's the host of a podcast about cars, too, Consumer Guide Car Stuff, Consumer Guide Car Stuff podcast. The website is consumerguide.com. Welcome back, Tom. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Who are the winners and losers of 2024? I've got some questions about 25, but just give me the up and the down for the past year.
Yeah, most of the market was a winner in 2025. Sales are up. We're up to about 15.8 million, up from about 15.5 million last year. So slow, steady growth in overall market. And just general car sales. EV sales are up gently, too. They're up about 1%, from 8% of the market to about 9% of the market, which is good news. But if you're looking for, like, some big winners, the automakers selling small, affordable crossovers did very well. And there's a couple of new vehicles in that segment. And we're talking about vehicles like the Chevrolet Trek, the Hyundai Kona, the Kia Seltos, things like that. These vehicles have snuck up on us a little bit. They've gotten slightly larger and a little bit more premium in feel. But that's the new growth segment, the subcompact crossover segment. And the Chevy Trax is taking the market by storm. Chevy has started selling this little crossover last year that you can get for about $22,000, and it's roomy, and it's fuel efficient, and it's comfortable, and it has hit a sweet spot with American shoppers.
I see so many big SUVs on the road. You think smaller ones are the new trend, huh?
They seem to be, yeah. I mean, compact crossovers have always been hot. We're talking about vehicles like the CR-V and the RAV4, and I don't think that market's going to shrink. But the larger things, so things like the Honda Pilot, the Chevrolet Traverse, the Traverse, which was redesigned for this year, that might be shrinking slightly as we move forward, as people downsize a little bit.
Man, those things are just so expensive. I mean,
yes,
they're fabulous, but they're expensive.
Yeah, an interesting thing that happened, too, after COVID, and when fewer people were in the market, what we've seen is that the price of midsize SUVs has gone up as makers add top trim levels. So they've removed more affordable and less profitable lower trim levels on these vehicles and added higher trim levels that cost more money. So it is not weird now for a midsize crossover, something that we thought was a $40,000 vehicle, to now break $60,000.
I got to tell you, I have a Subaru Crosstrek Hybrid that I drive. And it's 11 years old, and the air was out of the tire the other day. I drove over a screw, and I had a tow guy come out to help me. And I said, I've never changed the tire on the back of this thing before. Can you give me a hand with that? He goes, dude, you don't have a spare tire. I go, what do you mean? So we went in the back and lifted up the little carpet thing, and I said, it's under that metal plate. And he goes, no, that's your battery. That's your hybrid battery. You don't have a spare tire. How did I buy a car that doesn't have a spare tire?
I forgot about that. And the Crosstrek Hybrid was just a couple of year only offering, so that's kind of a rare car.
Yeah, lucky me.
But,
yeah.
But yeah, they had to get a hybrid battery in there someplace, so you lost a little donut spare tire in the process.
Not sure what that hybrid battery is doing for me, except flash a warning on my dashboard all the time that says check hybrid system, and I don't even know what that means. I haven't done it yet. Okay, enough about me. What are you liking for 2025?
Some good stuff out there. Buick, this is a very interesting reformation, too, is that Buick, which just sells four crossovers now, no cars, which is a weird thing if you think about the history of Buick. But like the Trax that I mentioned earlier, they have a version of that vehicle built at the same place, and it's called the Invista. And this is a car that you can get for like $25,000, and it is a small, surprisingly luxurious, quiet, and refined vehicle. And I think that that is really what's driving stuff moving forward. I think new buyers might be slowly getting back into the market, and they don't want something cheap. We Americans tend to reject totally cheap vehicles, but they like value vehicles. And I think that's where the growth segment's going to be. EVs are going to be interesting because we don't know what's going to happen with the tax credits moving forward, though there is a lot of strong suggestion we're going to lose them, which means that we're going to lose some EV sales next year.
Last time we spoke, the question was, should I hurry up and go buy one now? Do I still get a tax credit if I buy it in January?
Yes, you do. Yeah, that program is still active, so you might still want to do that. And people should remember, too, if your dealer can work with you on this, if the vehicle doesn't qualify for the federal tax credit as a sales credit, you can probably lease the vehicle and qualify for a version of that credit. So ask your dealer about that.
Does it matter where that vehicle, that EV, is made in order to get that credit?
If it's made in North America right now, no. So any of the old NAFTA states, the USMCA states, qualify.
Is that most of them? I don't know where cars get made.
Yes, that is most of them.
Yeah, okay. And then what are you hearing about tariffs and car prices as a result? Obviously, none of this has happened yet, but what about that?
There are two imminent tax activities that may happen to seriously impact the auto industry next year. One is the revocation of the federal tax credit for buying a car, so consumers will be impacted. We will probably lose the $7,500 tax credit for a purchase and the equivalent lease credit. But the other one, probably not going to happen because it is so draconian, and that is that the next administration had talked about applying a $25% tariff on vehicles imported from Canada or Mexico, which would be so disruptive that it would actually probably end sales for a few months while manufacturers tried to regroup. But the people I've talked to don't seem to think that this is going to happen, and no one is preparing for this because it's too hard to prepare for.
No kidding. Or too hard to imagine. But
yes. Yes.
It would affect the price of the vehicles, period, right?
It would, yeah. There is so much capital investment in Mexico for manufacturing by American automakers that the impact would be crushing, and the price increases would be huge. And right now, a lot of what keeps cars affordable in the U.S. is that labor costs in Mexico are lower than in the North America, in the U.S. or in Canada, and more affordable vehicles are built there for that reason.
Talk about Tesla for a second. What's on your radar there?
Interesting stuff going on at Tesla. For the first year ever, they had experienced a sales decline from one year to another. It's small, from about 18 million globally. I'm sorry, 1.8 million globally to about 1.7 million. Not a big deal, but it does reflect the fact that Tesla is in fact being impacted by competition, and there's a lot of good competition out there. Moving forward, Tesla is a bit of a mystery. They're talking about building a cheaper vehicle than the ones that they build now. But one wonders if there's money there for Tesla to be had, because they're already deeply discounting the Model 3 and the Model Y to keep the volume up there. The robo-taxi business is not something that's going to turn a profit for them anytime soon. That's something that's half a decade away, at least, if it ever happens. So they need... I'm surprised there isn't a news story out there that's a little bit more optimistic and a little bit more near-term.
Yeah, are they still the EV leader?
By a lot. Yeah, in the U.S., Tesla still sells about half the cars, but they used to sell more like 65-70% of the EVs. So they're losing market share in the U.S., and they're losing market share in China, which is a big market for them, too. So something has to happen for them to kind of turn things around, or stockholders certainly are going to lose interest in the company.
One last thing about that, then I'll pause and then we'll come back with questions. 312-981-7200. You want to talk to Tom Appel? Here's your chance. The Tesla truck is on our mind for unrelated reasons these days. Are they going to keep making that thing, and is it going to continue to look like that?
Probably in the near term, yes. They're selling a fair amount of them. They sold 60,000 of them, I think, in October,
wow,
which made it the best-selling EV pickup truck. But that's not a huge number relative to the numbers we were promised. We were told at one point that there were 2 million hand raisers that had put a deposit down on the vehicle. That turns out to not be anything close to the case, because you can order one now and get one in a week. So there is no line waiting to get into the vehicle. So they will probably need to update that, because all the interest right now is probably just because it's new and weird.
It is odd looking. Every now and then one goes by me and I think it just doesn't look done yet. Tom Appel, ConsumerGuide.com, 312-981-7200 will answer your questions as well. Steve Grzanich has some business news.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based McDonald's is ending some of its diversity practices. It's the latest big company to shift or end policies because of Republican backlash against diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, also known as DEI. Walmart, John Deere, Harley-Davidson, and others have already rolled back DEI initiatives in the past year. McDonald's will retire specific goals for achieving diversity at senior leadership levels and will end a program that encourages suppliers to develop diversity training and increase minorities in their own leadership ranks. McDonald's says the changes have been under consideration over recent months and are the result of several factors, including a U.S. Supreme Court decision banning affirmative action in college admissions. The New York Times has named Loaf Lounge in Chicago's Avondale neighborhood as one of the 22 best bakeries in the country. The Times singled out Loaf Lounge's sandwiches, oatmeal cream pies, and sourdough bread. The bakery went viral when it created the very chocolate cake for the TV show The Bear. Loaf Lounge is located at 2934 North Milwaukee Avenue. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you, sir. Now the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And yesterday we heard from Heather Van Voorhis, who had passed out from abdominal pain at the age of 9 and was told by her pediatrician that there was nothing wrong and to stop whining.
That was worse than being told we don't know what's wrong with you.
She found out years later she had the most common chronic health disorder in the country, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome.
And that was when I became determined to get this information out there as books to people, and then to get the products out there for people as well, so that they had some tangible help that they could put in their guts that would make them feel better.
What that help is, after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today, there has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. Heather Van Voorhis lives in Seattle, and a company she started in a one-room apartment
has turned into a 25,000-square-foot certified organic manufacturing facility.
Heather says her years of research and trial and error found that one of the keys to calming down an angry tummy caused by IBS is peppermint.
By a huge coincidence, the best peppermint in the world actually grows in my own backyard. Right here in eastern Washington.
Which she sells in capsule and teabag forms.
Which physically help relax the gut, calm down pain, spasms, cramps.
And regarding fiber, which we are told all the time to eat more of, Heather says insoluble fiber can actually be a trigger for IBS. But soluble fiber may be able to help.
There's great science and research behind soluble fiber as a bowel motility regulator, behind peppermint and peppermint oil. The fennel tummy tea as a carminative to help reduce bloating and gas.
And two of the most unpleasant things we don't want to talk about, diarrhea and
constipation.
She says her soluble fiber can help.
You can absolutely do it with your tummy fiber, but it might take several weeks, even several months, as you gradually work up your dose.
But before all that, Heather says see an MD, rule out anything else that may be going on. And if you want more info and a discount code, go to WGNradio.com or
HeathersTummyCare.com.
HeathersTummyCare.com.
I hear from teachers, I hear from cops, I hear from nurses, I hear from people who have children with IBS that are really struggling.
On the food calendar, it's National Shrimp Tempura Day, and I'm just looking at Heather's IBS diet cheat sheet here, and shrimp is okay, the fried part is not. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
We're talking with Tom Appel, the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. He hosts a podcast, too, Consumer Guide Car Stuff, where they talk about, I guess, car stuff. What's the number one vehicle or topic people are interested in? Is it the smaller size crossovers?
Yeah, people like the small crossovers. We've been talking a lot this year about affordability, a problem that's been exacerbated a little bit by high interest rates, and then electric vehicles. There's a lot of people not anywhere close to buying an electric vehicle, but they just kind of want to know about them.
And you did say that EV sales did tick up this year, right?
Yes.
So
yeah, EV demand is growing, and it's a situation, too, where there's more and more product out there. Manufacturers are still delivering brand-new EV products out there, and they are kind of exciting. So there is a market for it.
Outside of Tesla, who's got a good vehicle EV-wise?
Interesting now is the Chevrolet Equinox EV. They lowered the price, or they made available a base model now that is $35,000, and it does qualify for the federal tax credit. So you're looking at a vehicle with almost 300 miles of range for $27,500, which is that's accessible, and it's a nice, with the small crossovers we're talking about, it fits right into that segment, so room for four people, and it's a pretty decent little car.
Is that all electric, or is that electric hybrid? Does it have a gas tank?
That is all electric, although hybrids are interesting, too, because there's been a mad dash by Americans to buy hybrid vehicles this year, and we've seen the manufacturers that sell hybrid vehicles do very well.
But you talked about the pro and con of that. That is, that's a heavy battery you're carrying, though, and if you're lazy about charging it, then you're driving around with a gas tank hauling several hundred pounds that you really don't need.
Yeah, that's specifically plug-in hybrids, yeah. And if you're going to buy a plug-in hybrid, commit to plugging in. Yeah, otherwise it's a waste of money, and you're going to see reduced mileage versus a conventional hybrid because, like, as you just noted, you're hauling around a heavy battery for no reason.
And I guess people do that. Carl, you're on WGN with Tom Appel. What's your question, Carl?
Yeah, hi, John. Tom, any background on the heard a new, or they're bringing back the Honda Prelude?
This is exciting if you loved Preludes. The Honda Prelude was a sporty version of the Accord for a lot of years, not the Civic. They're bringing it back as a pure hybrid, and the big news here is that Honda is developing an all-new hybrid architecture that is specifically hybrid. Usually hybrids are just sort of electrified versions of gasoline-powered vehicles. In this case, Honda is developing new architecture. The car looks sporty. You can see pictures of it. I'm trying to think if I have a picture on my website or not. I think I do. Yeah, we'll see that in a year or two.
Oh, that long, though, huh?
Yeah.
The average new car price in America now is about $42,000, isn't it?
A little higher than that. I saw $48,000 recently.
What does he think of the Genesis GV60 EV, says one of our listeners?
Yeah, the Genesis is Hyundai's luxury brand, and the GV60 is specifically an electric small crossover. I think it is an absolute delight, actually. It's fun to drive, a little bit pricey for an EV, but beautiful interior. It's everything that a Genesis is, plus it's electric and it's very quick. I love the car. It is a very slow seller, so if you see one on a lot, you might be able to do some negotiating.
Is it safe to have the fast charge jumpers in your car? They have lithium batteries.
Oh, I think we're talking about just a portable charger. Yeah, that's fine. You just want to keep it in the trunk or someplace where it's not going to get too hot or too cold. They're safe.
There's no issue with batteries exploding or catching fire or anything? That used to be a concern.
Yeah, it is. And early on with lithium-ion batteries, we ran into lots of problems. People might remember when Nikon cameras were bursting into flames for no good reason. But our early experiences with lithium we've learned from them.
Here's a question from John. I'm glad you called in, John, because I was going to ask this, too, and didn't get around to it. You're on with Tom Appel. Go ahead, John.
I just want to ask about if he has any update on that Nissan-Toyota merger, because I don't know what that impact is going to have on the Lexus Infiniti brands.
The merger is not Nissan-Toyota. It is Nissan-Honda, yeah. And it seems to be a go. So we have Honda and Nissan. Honda seems to be in very good shape, business-wise, financially, in terms of sales. And I'm not entirely certain yet what's in this for Honda, but they're going to be taking basically control of Nissan. And this deal is going to come through in the middle of 2026 with basically Honda leadership at the helm. There's a lot going on there. One of the things that Nissan needs is hybrid technology, which Honda has, And Nissan does have some EV technology, which Honda can use. So I think that that is the obvious synergy there. It is going to happen. And the Infiniti brand could be in trouble. That is Nissan's luxury brand. And sales there have slowed for years. We could see that brand be phased out at some point.
Who makes the Lexus? Is that Toyota?
Lexus is Toyota. I think that brand is perfectly safe. That's a great brand.
Folks that have that car love that car. At least that's what they tell me. Tom Appel is the publisher of the Consumer Guide Automotive website. He's also the host of a Consumer Guide Car Stuff podcast. Find out more at consumerguide.com. Nice to talk to you, Tom.
You too, John. Thanks.